This is a very serious podcast.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to this episode of Splanknicks. This is season 2, episode 3. I'm your host, independent author Claire Walker. I'm joined by my co-host, my daughter, Hannah Kubiak.
Hello.
Say hello, Hannah.
Hello.
Hannah is a theater professional, an artist, and also an author.
Yes.
Now, my friends, there are only 3 things worth doing during the worst North American polar vortex season in a century. Drive madly through horrendous snowstorms, shovel said snow from one's drive and walkway, and read books by and about Oscar Wilde. So today is a book club episode, and we're diving into Oscar Wilde's 1891 novel, The Picture of Dorian Gray. Is it a manifesto advocating libertine free thinking? Or is it a cautionary tale of self-absorption and moral decay? Stay tuned.
Welcome to Splanknicks, the Society for the Preservation of Literature, the Arts, Numinosity, Culture, Humor, Nerdiness, Inspiration, Creativity, and Storytelling.
Welcome back, everybody. So we are ready to dive into Oscar Wilde's 1891 novel, The Picture of Dorian Gray. Oscar Wilde, born in 1854 in Dublin, Ireland. And he died November 30th, 1900 in Paris, France. So his career included public speaking, editorship of various periodicals, the writing of essays, critical reviews, plays, short stories, poems, and one novel. So this novel that we're going to be discussing, The Picture of Dorian Gray, Wilde said this about it. He said, "It contains much of me in it. Basil Hallward is what I think I am. Lord Henry is what the world thinks of me. Dorian, what I would like to be in other ages, perhaps." So that is, I found that little statement of Wilde's helpful as I read the book. So the novel came out in, originally, it actually was published as a novella in a periodical called Lippincott's Monthly. That was in 1890. And the next year it came out in full novel form, slightly edited. So it's, Wilde was already rather famous at the time. He was, dare I say it, already an influencer. He had a public speaking career. He had been on tours of the United States and the United Kingdom, went around, you know, making all those statements for which he is so famous. Things like, "There's only one thing worse than being talked about, and that is not being talked about." He made up those epigrams and paradoxes and just spouted them off at will, apparently. So, so that's sort of the context of this book coming out, is he's already quite well known. He's written some plays, but mostly he's known for his essays and poems. And then his novel, then this novel comes out.
A little bit about the plot of The Picture of Dorian Gray. It follows this young man, Dorian Gray, who is a minor English nobleman. Now, Mom, does that mean that he is young, or he is like, he's a young English nobleman, or does it mean that he's kind of a lower level English nobleman?
He's minor, as in he's not very high ranking. He was either just independently wealthy or had come into some money, but usually that meant that there was some sort of title or peerage.
So I don't think he had a title,
but he was certainly wealthy.
Yeah, he was wealthy.
And he came from a wealthy family, so.
Yeah. The other main characters are his friends, Basil Hallward, who is an artist who specializes in portraiture, and Lord Henry Wotton, a minor English nobleman, pillaging for gold and silver. well, he's a minor. Yes, he's also a minor English nobleman, and he is a devotee of the aesthetic movement. And we're going to talk about aestheticism a little bit later on. So the story begins with Basil painting Dorian's portrait And Henry is there as well. And he starts to talk about his philosophy of aestheticism, the primacy of youth and hedonism. And it has a very profound effect on Dorian, who is very young and impressionable. Not only is he a minor English nobleman, but he's also a minor English nobleman. And Basil is so intent on his task of painting that he fails to notice what a negative effect Henry's remarks are having on his already vain young protege. So Dorian is a very good-looking young man. He's becoming vain already, but then Henry telling him all of this stuff kind of brings that to the forefront and all that. So Dorian becomes convinced that he is already living the peak of his existence. So from this moment on, his greatest attributes, like his youthful energy and his physical beauty, will only deteriorate as he succumbs to the effects of aging. And it doesn't help that Basil's portrait is a masterpiece that captures Dorian in his current state of physical perfection. So the youth, innocence, purity, vigor, they're all wonderfully depicted in this painting. So Dorian, like, he has a little bit of a tantrum about it, and he makes this sort of fateful and tragic wish that he would retain his perfect appearance forever and that the painting would age instead of him. And it's never explained why or how it happens, and I honestly don't think it's that important in the course of the story. But Dorian's wish comes true, and as he gets older, he remains handsome and youthful, and the image of him on the canvas does age, and it also shows visible evidence of the state of his soul. And as Dorian lives a dissolute life of wantonness, cruelty, self-absorption, moral corruption, the image on the canvas becomes hideous and frightening. Later on in the story, he commits murder, and it becomes all blood-stained and everything.
Good summary. Mm-hmm. So one thing that's interesting, if you want to visualize this story, it's set in London of the late 1800s, the second mm-hmm. half of the 1800s, basically very close to the turn of the century. And some of the contemporaries of Wilde include Arthur Conan Doyle. They actually met. Arthur Conan Doyle's first Sherlock Holmes story, A Study in Scarlet, came out in 1887, so about 10 or 12 years before, or not 10 or 12 years, it was 1890, 1891, so 3 or 4 years before, using my amazing math skills there again, it came out just a few years before The Picture of Dorian Gray. He also was right around the time Bram Stoker was writing Dracula. Gilbert and Sullivan were writing and staging their light operas during this time. And in fact, Wilde was so famous and known as one of these sort of dandified aesthetes in London that he actually had a character in one of Gilbert and Sullivan's comic operas modeled after him. So he was famous enough to be spoofed.
Oh, wow.
he was also, Wilde was acquainted with James McNeill Whistler. He was an artist. I think George Bernard Shaw knew of him. I think they might have met, but I don't know for sure. Mm-hmm. So if you want to picture this story as you're reading it, just picture any good movie adaptation or televisation of any of the Sherlock Holmes stories, mm-hmm. the ones where they set it in late Victorian London with the hansom cabs and the coal, you know, wagons and the grubby, you know, children all around. So that's kind of how to picture it is in basically Sherlock Holmes's London is where this story takes place. The structure of the novel, it's in 20 chapters. The edition that I read had 180 pages in it. And as I read the book, I sort of kept track of the important major plot actions and plot beats. And it adheres almost perfectly to the three-act structure. The expected act breakdown of a 180 page book would be that we would do act one from pages 1 to about 45. We would have act two commence from there and begin and go until about page 135. And then Act Three, the sort of conclusion of the story, goes from about page 136 to 180. And I always take that three act structure. I take Act Two and I break it in half. And I call it Act 2A and Act 2B. And Act 2A ends about halfway through the book. And there's usually a quite momentous occurrence about halfway through the book. It's sometimes called the point of no return, page count wise and plot wise, where something pretty big happens at that point. And this is the way Dorian Gray goes. On chapter 4 begins on page 35 and ends on page 48. And that is the fateful moment when we find out that Dorian Gray announces that he's engaged to be married to this young woman, Sybil Vane, who he's become infatuated with. The first part of Act 2 begins, and it concludes with Chapter 8, which begins on page 74 in the edition I read. Now, during this chapter, Dorian has basically had a massive disappointment about Sybil. He had been sort of worshiping her as this sort of artistic genius, and she was just embodying all of the ideals of drama and Greek mythology, and she was playing all these roles so beautifully, and that's what Dorian fell in love with. Dorian convinces Henry and Basil to go to the play with him and watch Sybil perform. And what a dismal failure it was. And Dorian is so embarrassed. Basil and Henry are embarrassed for him. They can't believe that this is the actress who he's fallen in love with. And then Dorian also, he can't believe it either. He goes and he confronts Sybil and he says, "What's the matter with you?" And she says, "Oh, I realized that I found true love in you, Dorian. And I could no longer play at acting like I was in love because I really am in love. It all seems so trite and just stupid and pointless to pretend to be someone in love when I am so deeply in love." And so I don't know why, but she just decided to not even try, and she didn't care anymore about being an actress. Hmm. That turned out to be not what Dorian wanted to hear. He completely lost interest in her and really harshly rejected her, just really let her have it and said, I don't care about you anymore. And that is how Chapter 7 basically ends. And then Chapter 8 begins with Dorian is sort of, he's kind of feeling bad about that a little bit. And then he's like, well, maybe I'll go make it up with her. Maybe I'll go through with it. Maybe I was a bit harsh. Well, then Henry comes by and he finds out, and Henry tells him that Sybil has killed herself. And so Dorian wrestles with this a little bit. He does a little bit of interior. He's got some remorse and he's feeling a little bit bad about it, but eventually he shrugs it off and he goes to the opera. And the chapter ends with this stunning statement. Listen to this. "An hour later, Dorian was at the opera and Lord Henry was leaning over his chair." Henry, you remember in chapter one or chapter two, when Henry is just blathering on and bloviating about aestheticism, yeah, and youth, and you know, youth is the only thing worth having, and he's just all these ridiculous statements, and Dorian is becoming more and more, you know, in his thrall, you know, as he just spouts all this nonsense, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, during that chapter, I was thinking to myself, someone needs to tell Henry to shut his mouth, you know, because you know, but Basil was just oblivious in his painting, didn't notice.
Yeah,
and it occurred to me, we're going to have to circle around back to this, but I thought, okay, Lord Henry, he's the devil in this story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and notice this, how chapter 8 ends. "An hour later, Dorian was at the opera. Lord Henry was leaning over his chair." That is the devil in a posture of total mastery over Dorian, mm-hmm, in a possessive posture over him, you know, and that's the halfway mark of the book. You know, Sybil Vane is dead. Dorian is thoroughly corrupted. There's no going back.
Mm-hmm.
And I was in awe of Wilde's craftsmanship at how he had structured this book.
Yeah.
So I'll I can continue with the rest of the second half of the book, unless you have any comments on that, or should I continue?
Yeah, I mean, I took a couple of notes while I was reading. I didn't take quite as many notes as you did, but I took some notes, mostly sort of like quotations that I thought were kind of cool or thematic.
Yeah.
And one of the most of the little speech that Lord Harry made at the beginning, when he's just sort of, you know, blathering on while Basil is painting and Dorian is sitting for the portrait.
Yeah.
This is part of what Henry says. He says, we are punished for our refusals. Every impulse that we strive to strangle broods in the mind and poisons us. The body sins once and has done with its sin, for action is a form of purification. Nothing remains but the recollection of pleasure, the luxury of regret. The only way to get rid of a temptation is to yield to it. Resist it, and your soul grows sick with longing for the things it has forbidden itself, with desire for what its monstrous laws have made monstrous and unlawful. So yeah. That it's kind of the sort of things that Lord Harry says, like his words are kind of like poison and they get into Dorian's head. And at first he's kind of like, stop. I don't know what you're saying. And he gets confused and he goes out into the garden, but then he ends up yielding to this temptation. And the sort of, you know, once you, it's kind of like you think, like his whole speech here, the only way to get rid of a temptation is to yield to it. Like you kind of, when you think about that for a second, you're like, wait a minute. Like, maybe.
Well, the thing
and then you think, wait, no.
The statement is not false. The only way to get rid of a temptation is to yield to it. That's not entirely false, because if you yield to the temptation, it's no longer a temptation, right?
Yeah, no, it's not. It's just a thing you've done. Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. And it becomes, it's not a temptation anymore, but it's not the only way to deal with a temptation. Another way to deal with a temptation is to resist it.
Is to not do the thing. Yeah.
Dorian goes out into the garden. Mm-hmm. Where else was a devil tempting someone in a garden?
Mm-hmm.
This is an Edenic. This is like Eden, because mm-hmm. Basil's garden of his studios. It's the way Wilde describes it. It's lush. It's mm-hmm. warm out. It's beautiful. There are bees. There are flowers. Everything. And Dorian goes out into the garden just to try and get away from this trickster, Henry. Mm-hmm. And the trickster follows him out into the garden and continues to poke him.
Yeah.
By the time he goes back in, you know, he's really done it. And then, you know, Dorian is infected with the idea that he wants to retain his youth perpetually. So
mm-hmm.
yeah, really, 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 really awful.
Yeah. Oh, it's kind of like, cause the devil tells this lie in the garden. That he says, no, if you eat the fruit, you won't die, you know? Yeah. And so, yeah, Dorian definitely eats the fruit believing that, thinking that, well, if I stay young forever, and if the portrait gets old instead, then I'll never die. I'll never get old and I'll never die.
Yeah.
So that's a cool little parallel, the whole thing with the garden. I didn't notice that before.
Yeah. I mean, as we were talking, I remember I read this version of the book. It's called, This Is Excellent.
Mm-hmm.
Can you see it?
Yeah.
It's the Norton Critical Edition. Mm-hmm. You see that?
Yeah.
It's annotated. I highly recommend that when you read a book from a past era where there's a lot of just odd statements and customs and different things that we don't really know about, vocabulary, read a good annotated version of the book, because it'll help you with things. It helped me a lot. And one of the things that the editor of this edition mentioned is that the garden that he goes out into is described in such lush terms, with all this exoticness, and it's meant to maybe evoke the idea of Eden.
Mm-hmm.
But then I didn't make the connection about the Garden of Eden and the temptation until just now, because you said Henry followed Dorian out into the garden.
Oh yeah.
And that's the connection. That's Henry doing basically his role in the story, which is he's the devil.
Yeah.
So let me continue with the second half of the book. I guess years have passed, right? Remember, years and years pass. Mm-hmm. And we see all of this. We see what's happened to Dorian since he just sort of shrugged off the death of Sybil Vane and became this just horrible, self-absorbed person. And, you know, he gets infatuated with all these aesthetic things, you know, perfume and music and musical instruments and artworks and precious stones. He becomes obsessed with
so sick
stuff.
Of reading all of that. I was like, the stuff about, there was like an entire chapter where it was like talking about all of the stones that he collected, all the precious gems and things. And it said that he would spend like an entire day in there just like looking at his collection and all that. And like, I don't know. I was just like, oh.
Yeah. So well,
it just struck me as kind of icky for some reason. I don't know why.
It is icky because it's this obsession with feeling things and sensual experiences, you know, these stones and the music and then there's a whole list of things where he's listing all these names, lots of names.
Yeah.
And the annotations were very helpful because they pointed out who all these people were and why those were significant. So anyway, yeah. So Dorian's going through all of this, you know, he's living the life of an aesthete, basically. An aesthete is someone who adheres to this aestheticism. Mm-hmm. And he's all into just sensory experiences and new emotions and new sensations and all this stuff, just seeking after all this pleasure all the time. Anyway, so he's doing this and he gets to the point where he's developed a real reputation for himself.
Yeah.
And Basil comes over to confront him.
Yeah.
Basil says,
yeah, like he was corrupting other young men and stuff, just like Henry did to him. Like he was becoming a devil himself.
Yeah. I mean, Basil said to him, every young man with whom you've been associated has ended up going wrong, going bad.
Yeah. You know? They either kill themselves or they disappear.
Yeah.
Or they just become like a bad reputation.
Yeah. So. And Basil is just pleading with Dorian saying, please deny it. Just tell me that you're not doing all this stuff, you know, give me some hope here because you're my friend. Dorian eventually decides to take Basil up to the secret room where he has hidden the portrait. Mm. Earlier on in the book, Dorian decided to have the portrait brought up to a room at the top of the house, and only he has the key, and he just keeps it in there under lock and key, under a veil, under a curtain. And he goes up to look at it every once in a while and sort of probably sort of marvels and gloats at the fact that he's quote unquote getting away with all of this, this dissolute living and all of these horrible, you know, things. And the portrait is becoming just horrific, you know, turning into this horrible thing. And so Dorian takes Basil up to the secret room where the portrait is hidden. Basil is appalled and he realizes, so it's true. Everything you've done is true. And once again, like you said, they don't explain how this magical transformation of the portrait takes place. Mm-hmm. Again, like you said, that's not really important. It's it's a small element of supernaturalism that kind of makes the picture of Dorian Gray into a good example of a late Victorian Gothic novel. You know, the spooky house and the creepy picture at the top of the house and this little sort of element of supernaturalism. Anyway, so Dorian takes Basil up to the secret room and Basil is appalled. And here comes the key moment. Basil alternately remonstrates with him and then finally urges him to repent, you know, confess, pray for forgiveness, you know, something. It's not too late. You can turn this around. And this, because he sees the state of Dorian's soul, but he's a good man, and he knows that he could turn this around if he wanted to. And then you see Dorian on the threshold, right? He's so close. Remember that moment, that moment of grace, where basically see every story written by Flannery O'Connor to see this moment of grace and how people respond to it. They're confronted with something. Here's their chance, but. What Dorian does is he cements his moral demise by refusing all of Basil's entreaties, and then he stabs him to death, just in cold blood, just knifes him. that's three quarters of the way through the book. In when you're analyzing a plot, some of the plot analyses that I've read refer to that as the major setback.
Yeah, that he murdered somebody in his house and now he has a dead body to deal with. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And also he's completely damned his soul at this point.
Yeah.
He's refused the moment of grace. He's done. Yeah.
He's done. Yeah. And so what happens in Act Three is we see all of the chickens come home to roost. We see what happens to Dorian. He actually ends up having a confrontation with Sybil Vane's brother and barely escapes with his life because he realizes that the way he looks now is exactly how he looked, what was it, 18 years prior?
Mm-hmm.
He says to James Vane, I can't possibly be the person who your sister fell in love with and was referring to as Prince Charming. Mm-hmm. I can't possibly be me. And James Vane is just like, oh, yeah, I guess you're right.
Kid. Yeah.
so we let Dorian go. But then one of these women of ill repute comes up to James Vane and says, if you were looking for this guy Prince Charming is what Sybil called him. If that's who you're looking for, that was him. Mm-hmm. Something is just off about him. And that really is him. He's looked that way the entire time because this woman apparently came under his influence early on and was corrupted by him also. So James Vane tries to get to find him, but he can't find him. But then we see Dorian, he's trying to reconcile. He's in fear for his life now because he knows that James Vane is possibly looking for him, and he kind of sees him under every rock and behind every curtain or whatever. Mm-hmm. And then in fact he does see him. We realize that James Vane has followed him out to his country house and he's there looking at it through the window, So Dorian panics and he spends like the last two chapters just panicking. And they go on, they go out for a hunt, right? They're out shooting, having some sport.
Yes.
And conveniently James Vane is shot to death in a hunting accident. Somebody accidentally shoots him.
Yeah.
Hiding in the bushes somewhere, trying to maybe get to Dorian. And he ends up taking a shotgun blast straight to the chest.
So, yeah.
So he's dead. Dorian thinks, oh, phew, I'm off the hook. But he's not off the hook because his conscience is still bothering him. And he decides he's going to, He makes a resolution to change, to become good. And then who does he encounter immediately when he's thinking?
Henry.
And he's like, no. What nonsense. You don't have to repent, old chap. That's very, very old fashioned, right?
Yes.
So he basically tells him, don't, this is pointless. Don't be so stupid. Mm-hmm. And so he doesn't. But ultimately, what happens is Dorian goes up to his secret room where he sees the painting. He sees the truth in it and he's outraged and disgusted. And then he picks up the same knife that he used to kill Basil,
mm-hmm.
and he stabs the canvas.
Mm-hmm.
And then mysteriously, a horrible cry is heard throughout the house.
Mm-hmm.
And then later on, servants who heard this horrible cry, there was probably something supernatural in it. That's probably yet another element of supernaturalism that was in the story, just to give that a
probably when the like in the Chamber of Secrets when Harry stabs the diary or whatever, and then the ghost of Tom Riddle starts like going to pieces, that kind of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You can imagine something like that. Like if they were to make a movie out of this now, it'd probably be some supernatural, horrible, sound. Anyway, mm-hmm. so later on, the servants, they can't get into the room because Dorian has the key and he's in there. They mm-hmm. they break into the room, though, and they see dead on the floor with a knife in his heart, a horrible, wizened, disgusting old man.
Mm-hmm.
And the portrait is there, restored to its original state, depicting Dorian Gray in the flower of his youth and innocence.
So, well, at least no art was actually harmed in the making of this.
No art was actually harmed.
No art was actually harmed.
In the making of this story. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I don't, it's kind of a funny reaction that I had, but when it when it said that they found hanging upon the wall a splendid portrait of their master as they had last seen him in all the wonder of his exquisite youth and beauty. And then it says, lying on the floor was a dead man in evening dress with a knife in his heart. And I was like, oh, thank God, the portrait's okay.
Oh, yeah.
Oh,
look at you.
My art.
That's funny. Oh, that's man. Funny. And you know what's interesting about that is again, Oscar Wilde, genius. Check out the book ending that he did. Two mm-hmm. bookends. Someone coming at that portrait with a knife.
Yeah. Oh yeah, because Basil was going to destroy it at the beginning when
right at the beginning, yeah.
Chapter was freaked out about it.
Yeah, chapter one or chapter two, whenever it was that they completed the portrait, and yeah, and Dorian's going, you know, out of his mind. Basil's like, okay, never mind. I'm just going to destroy this thing, and he goes after it with a palette knife, and Dorian stops him.
Yeah,
and then at the end of the book, Dorian picks up the knife that he used to kill Basil, ironically enough, and stabs the picture with it. So I thought that was really great. So I think structurally, this novel is, it's perfect. It's very good. Very good.
Let's talk about the relationship between the body and the soul.
Okay.
There's a couple of quotes in here about it. Like Dorian says, how sad it is. I shall grow old and horrible and dreadful, but this picture will remain always young. It will never be older than this particular day of June. If it were only the other way, if it were I who was to be always young and the picture that was to grow old, for that, I would give everything. I would give my soul for that. This didn't really occur to me until I gave that reference about Chamber of Secrets earlier, that like the painting, the portrait is kind of like a Horcrux, isn't it? Like from Harry Potter, you know?
Huh.
Store your soul in it. And then what would have been interesting would have been if James Vane had actually tried to kill Dorian and like it just didn't work, like he just didn't die.
Yeah,
because that I think that's probably what would have happened if there had been an attempted murder, because I don't think he would have died, honestly.
How like interesting.
Like nothing would have happened to him. Maybe the painting would have been damaged in some way, but I don't think Dorian would have been. There's a lot of other like mentions of the connection between the soul and the body. There's this quote that says, there was an animalism in the soul and the body had its moments of spirituality. The senses could refine and the intellect could degrade. Who could say where their fleshy impulse ceased and the physical impulse began? Was the soul a shadow seated in the house of sin, or was the body really in the soul? The separation of spirit from matter was a mystery, and the union of spirit with matter was a mystery also. Which I think is kind of why we don't really get an explanation as to why his wish about the portrait comes true, because it's a mystery why our bodies, why we have soul and body, and how they're linked together. So then also how they get separated is another thing entirely. Yeah, I just think that's really cool. That like I think when Dorian made that wish, he kind of like severed his soul from his body, because he kind of devoted himself to this sort of, I guess, sensual life, all the sensual pleasures he became obsessed with, and he didn't really think about the soul anymore because he kind of cut himself off from that. And the soul was packed away in the attic with the painting, and he's just kind of like this unnatural shell walking around.
Yeah.
You know, weird.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I get it. What you're saying, that fatal wish that he made, that fatal, reckless wish.
Mm-hmm.
He separated his soul from his body. Mm-hmm. And so he was just a body going around seeking bodily and sensual pleasures, mm-hmm. including intellectual pleasures. That's what the whole thing about music, not music necessarily, but you know, learning about embroideries and learning about music and learning about, you know, mm-hmm. precious stones and all that stuff.
The next thing we have in our notes here is about the cult of personality, or how to create a narcissist. So
yeah,
like in chapter 9, Basil finally confesses to Dorian the same thing that he had told Harry about the portrait, that, you know, he said, oh no, I will never show this portrait. It has too much of myself in it, which is really, really kind of, is it ironic? I don't know. That later Dorian hides the portrait for that exact reason. He's like, yes, it has too much of myself in it. You know, but Basil says that he had become obsessed with Dorian and idolized him and kind of thought of him as his muse, kind of had a crush on him, you know? And it's a little bit less obvious in the novel because, you know, like homosexuality was illegal back then. But in the original Lippincott's version of the story, it was a lot more like explicitly obvious that Basil like was experiencing homosexual ardor for Dorian. Yeah, in the book, that's a little bit more toned down, like not by much, because I definitely still got that impression from reading the book. But
it's definitely toned down, and in fact, I think that you can still profitably read this book
mm-hmm.
without knowing anything about that aspect of it, because there is some coded language, you know, throughout mm-hmm. the book and some of that in there, but you know, it stands alone without that. And then the so you don't necessarily need to read all of those layers into it, although they're there.
Mm-hmm.
And the story can be experienced you know, just as the
yeah
sort of Basil as this sort of really enthusiastically admiring Dorian because of how handsome he is and what a joy it is to paint him.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
he's almost like his muse or his sort of inspiration for some of his best work.
And yeah, like how to create a narcissist. Say things to him like, you were made to be worshipped.
Yeah.
Is something exactly. that, I forget who said that.
Basil said that.
Basil said that to Dorian.
Oh. Yeah. Basil said that to Dorian when he was explaining all of his stuff about how the reason why he didn't want to exhibit the painting at first, because it's too much of me in it. In other words, what he meant is everyone who looks at this painting is going to know that I am obsessed about and idolizing this
yeah.
model. That's what he was afraid was yeah. patently obvious in the,
everyone's going to know how I feel about you. Yeah.
Yeah. But in fact, nobody knew that.
Yeah.
And later on, Basil came to realize that he was just that, he was just overreacting.
Yeah,
he just did decide that he wanted to exhibit the painting. And you remember what Dorian's reaction was?
He said, no, there's too much of myself in it.
Yeah, he's like, no, you're not taking this painting away. And he wouldn't even let Basil look at it because it had been changing by then.
Mm-hmm.
And it was not going to be good to look at.
Yeah, no.
So that's
because, if anyone would notice that it was changing, it would be Basil.
Yeah, we've touched a little bit on
aestheticism.
Words are difficult. Aestheticism and hedonism.
Mm-hmm.
And let's see.
Epicureanism.
Epicureanism, right. These sort of sensual pleasure type things. So let's sort out these two words first, though. Aestheticism
mm-hmm.
versus asceticism.
Yeah.
There's two letters that make a big difference. There is there's a couple of E's that change the word.
Mm-hmm.
Aesthetics is the study of beautiful things.
Yes.
And asceticism
mm-hmm.
is the practice of self-denial and includes practices like fasting and mortification and abstinence and mm-hmm. other restrictions upon one's enjoyments
yeah.
or pleasures. So the two terms are nearly antonymous,
mm-hmm.
or antonymous, I should say, and antonymous, you know, the opposites.
Yeah.
Aesthetics and ascetics, it's different.
Yeah.
But aestheticism is the name given to this 19th century movement that sprung up in Europe and Great Britain, espousing the view that art can and should be merely beautiful and need not have any deeper meaning, didactic value, or moral utility of any kind. It was an intellectual and art movement supporting the emphasis of the purely aesthetic qualities of the arts more than any sort of other themes that you might ascribe to art in order to experience it in its fullness.
Right, you know? Like art for art's sake.
Correct. The person who coined that phrase was one of the principals of figures in this movement in Europe, Théophile Gautier in France. Oh. He coined that phrase, art for art's sake. And an aesthete is spelled A-E-S-T-H-E-T-E. An aesthete is a person who has or affects to have a special appreciation of art and beauty.
Ah.
And two of
so
the principal
like
figures.
Every college theater major, right?
Is an aesthete. not necessarily. But two of the principal figures in England who sort of founded this movement, Walter mm-hmm. Pater and John Ruskin, both of them were at Oxford. Both of them instructed Wilde.
Mm.
So he was very, he was in their orbit.
Right.
And I thought of, like, for example, here is a statement from the book uttered by Henry that when I read this, I was like, this is the aesthetic creed. Here's what he says. A chance tone of color in a room or a morning sky, a particular perfume that you had once loved and that brings subtle memories with it, a line from a forgotten poem that you had come across again, a cadence from a piece of music that you had ceased to play. I tell you, Dorian, that it is on things like these that our lives depend.
Right.
Those sort of intellectual, sensational, mm-hmm. artistic, blissful moments
mm-hmm.
That, you know, and this was kind of at loggerheads with the late Victorian view of art, which art was supposed to have some sort of moral utility to it. It was supposed to have instructive purpose to it, you know, teach mm-hmm. you things. And, you know, what you want is, you want a holistic view and appreciation of art. If you go all the way into all that matters is that I'm an artist and I'm expressing myself and I'm, you know, art for art's sake, mm-hmm. just throwing beauty down there. Well,
why?
Awesome. But that's pretty shallow. Why? And then, but the other way around is an art piece whose sole purpose is just to teach something.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you could call something that's horribly done with bad technique and just, you know, not very well, you know, good, and say, well, this is great art because it teaches you X, Y, Z.
Mm-hmm.
So, anyway, so that's aestheticism. And then it's very, very involved or wrapped up, I should say, entwined in something called hedonism. And hedonism is the search for pleasures, experiences, sensations, the desire for taking up a new obsession all the time. You know, that's what all the stuff about, you know, precious stones and perfumes and music and all that. It's all about the hedonism. And hedonism obviously has a lot of, you know, there's morally, you know, libertine values about sexual relations, for example. Also placing extremely high value on food and drink experiences. And they experimented with drugs. You know, a lot of these guys were doing, you know, opium and.
Oh, yeah. And the opium dens and stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. So here's a couple of statements from Henry that just show you that he is the sort of icon of the aesthete hedonist in this story. He says at one point, I'm always ready for a new emotion. And then another thing he says, he goes, one could never pay too high a price for any sensation. You know, you read that and you're like, what? A dumb thing to say. Of course you could pay too high a price for any sensation, but Henry just spouts off all this nonsense.
Mm-hmm. You know, he uses a lot of absolutes in his language. Like, I'm always ready for a new emotion. One could never pay too high a price, you know.
Yeah. There are only two things, you know. It's always, mm-hmm. Always those statements. Yeah, exactly. He's speaking in superlatives all the time.
Always, never.
And the other thing that's wrapped up in these two things, the hedonism, the aestheticism, is this Epicureanism.
Mm-hmm.
Most people think of this as, you know, sort of being a foodie or, you know, enjoying fine wine, you know, to some ridiculous degree.
Yeah.
It was named after Epicurus, and his motto was pleasure is man's greatest good.
Mm-hmm.
That pain is evil, always to be avoided, and finding literally no value in suffering whatsoever. No redemptive value, no didactic value, no character building value, none of that. You just mm-hmm. avoid it. And then the other thing too that that I in the edition that I read said that Dorian represented this sort of antinomianism of the aesthetes and the hedonism. Antinomianism is a word that comes from two Greek words, anti, meaning against, and nomos, meaning law. Antinomianism means against the law. So in it has a very specific meaning in Christianity. Mm-hmm. It's a heretical belief that says that because of the primacy of God's grace and mercy, those who profess belief in Christ are dispensed from the requirement to observe the moral law. It is essentially just rationalization of, you know, immorality because, oh, I'm saved. Awesome. I can just do what I want now.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
So that's a heresy. That's a heresy. No, no Orthodox with a little O Christian church would adhere to that.
No.
Okay. And then, but the concept also has a broader secular meaning. An antinomian is anyone who rejects the current social norms, laws, traditions, whatever the ethical and moral standards are of the time, whether explicitly in statements saying I'm against, you know, this this particular moral tradition, or just in the way they live. You know, you don't have to be, you don't have to say you're an antinomianism to act like one.
Mm-hmm.
So Henry's pronouncements, you know, are just announcing that he's an antinomian all over the place, and then Dorian's immoral life betrays his. And then the other thing that's all wrapped up in these concepts is decadence.
Yeah.
So, and decadence, we see it. That is what happens to Dorian's picture. It undergoes deterioration and decay. Mm-hmm. And because decadence means being morally corrupt or self-indulgence, you know, taking away all of those previously held standards of uprightness and excellent. You know, a decadent person or culture yields to corrupt impulses and tries to find joy in that and tries to find beauty in what's really just evil and ugly.
Mm-hmm.
Here's a minor example. You know how sometimes a very rich dessert is described as being decadent?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Because even though we know it's bad for us, we indulge it in any way and we enjoy it, you know. So
it's sinfully delicious.
Yes, yeah, sinfully delicious. Decadent. Yeah, very decadent. So decadence is, you know, and aestheticism and all of this quest for new sensations. This is what these guys were all about. And Henry and Dorian are, again, the icons of this. And Basil Hallward is the sort of moral compass of the story. He's like the reasonable person who's actually still got a conscience and still has some moral standards.
Mm-hmm. Which is why he gets stabbed.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, that's what happens. If you confront evil, you have to be prepared to pay the price. And I really loved Basil's last stand where he's up there looking at this picture. He knows that everything that he's heard about Dorian is true. And he still reaches out to him and still says, look, it's not too late. You can still reach out, you know, let us kneel down. Let's see if we can remember. He's trying to remember just random verses from the Bible that he just knows, you know, different prayers, you know, forgive us our trespasses. And, you know, even though your sins be as scarlet, they can become white as snow. You know, he's just trying. And and Dorian's like, nope, talk to the hand. In fact, talk to the knife. Brr, he stabs him. That was just a heart-wrenching scene.
And Dorian sleeps quite peacefully after that.
What were you going to talk about next?
We were going to tackle the similarities to Brideshead Revisited.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah, because I noticed a lot of similarities, as I'm sure you did. Charles is sort of thought of as being, he's kind of like this just nondescript guy. And then he becomes friends with Sebastian and meets this family. And I wouldn't say that he's exactly corrupted by them, but he does kind of become obsessed with them in a way.
Mm-hmm. There's this trio of friendship, mm-hmm. you know, in Dorian Gray, there's Henry and Basil and Dorian.
Mm-hmm.
And then in Brideshead Revisited, there's Charles, Sebastian, and Julia.
Mm-hmm.
You remember how in Brideshead Revisited, Anthony Blanche is like, every time he appears, it's to like throw these sort of barbs at Charles. He's the devil in that story. And Lord Henry so reminded me of Anthony Blanche.
Oh yeah. 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 Cause he would just, there was this, remember the scene when we were talking about when Anthony Blanche shows up talking to Charles and he just goes on and on and on for like pages about who knows what.
Yeah.
But
just bloviating on about.
Yeah, that definitely reminded me of Henry a little bit.
Yeah.
That he'll kind of, it's a bunch of noise almost. Like, look at all this noise, and sowing doubts just by the sheer volume of it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The volume as in how loud it is, and the volume as in how much it is. Yep.
How much it is. Yeah. How expansive, how much of it is. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. In fact, here's a statement that I made when I was putting in my notes. Mm-hmm. Evelyn Waugh wrote Brideshead Revisited, and it was set in World War I and just afterwards, bookended by some World War II experiences. So he set it back in the early 20th century. And I wonder, was Anthony Blanche based on Oscar Wilde?
I don't know. That's an interesting question.
Because he was an aesthete. He was known for his flamboyant clothing. Mm-hmm. He was known for flummery. All of this flummery and flippancy. And flummery is like empty compliments and nonsense. All these paradoxical statements. And, you know, that's what Anthony Blanche is doing every time he shows up. And this is what Henry does every time. And it's interesting. Oscar Wilde himself said, you know, he based Lord Henry on what people think of him. Uh-huh. Everyone thought he was just this flamboyant dandy, you know, person who wanted to be in the limelight all the time. Mm-hmm. And they were right. That's what he was doing. And he wasn't careful about the way he behaved in public either.
Yeah, he got in a lot of trouble for that.
Yeah. A lot of people don't know this, but Dorian Gray came out in 1890. He wrote he had a very good decade of writing. He wrote The Importance of Being Earnest, The Ideal Husband, just some fantastic plays for which he's very well known. But 1895, he was in jail, found guilty of, quote, gross indecency.
Yeah.
And he was sentenced to 2 years at hard labor, and he was finally released in 1897. 3 years later, he was dead.
Yeah.
So it broke him. Yeah. He made the mistake of tangling with a marquis, who is not a minor nobleman, but quite a high nobleman. The marquis, mm-hmm. or the
a marquis.
It looks like, I always thought it was pronounced Marquis, but apparently it's pronounced Marquis.
What?
Marquis. M-A-R-Q-U-I-S. Marquis.
Okay.
And it's one below Duke.
Dude.
So this guy is no slouch. I mean, Oscar Wilde, after all of his popular and critical successes, he was behaving recklessly. This guy, the Marquis of Queensberry, mm-hmm. Said some things about Wilde. And Wilde sued him for libel, but lost the case. Mm-hmm. But evidence from that trial led to him being arrested for "quote unquote" gross indecency. Mm-hmm. So he stepped in a hornet's nest, and he shouldn't have, because this guy, the Marquis of Queensberry.
Yeah,
his name was John Douglas.
Yeah,
he was the ninth Marquis of Queensberry, and he was known to be quite a violent person.
Oh.
Given to recklessness. He was not nice. He was an avid boxer, though, and he actually founded the Amateur Athletic Club of England and gave his name to the rules of boxing they still use them today, some of them.
Wow.
the 3-minute round.
Right.
The use of gloves in the bouts.
And, yeah,
10-second countdown for a knockout. This guy, Lord John Douglas, the ninth Marquis of Queensberry, basically advocated those rules. They're called the Queensberry rules.
Oh, wow.
Anyway, yeah. But anyway, you don't mess with him. He was a vindictive person, apparently. And he got his just desserts, though. He died of syphilis. Yeah.
Yes.
So
that was one of those diseases back then.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Like, in fact, yeah, when you see when people back in those days were institutionalized for insanity or bad neurological or mental diseases, mm-hmm. sometimes it was syphilis because it attacked the brain.
Yeah, yeah. It becomes a neurological thing later. Yeah.
Right. So yeah, it's quite horrible.
And also it would go undiagnosed because, like, you know where you get syphilis from.
Right. It wasn't something that you, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it wasn't something that you touted because you didn't get it anywhere of good repute.
Right. Right.
So I'm sure a lot of people didn't get treated for it and then they went insane.
The book has been viewed by some as a cautionary tale and not necessarily an endorsement of.
Well, I mean, if writing about something means that you agree with it 100%, if that's the philosophy you go with, then yeah, this is an endorsement. But just because you write about something doesn't mean that you yourself would do that thing, you know?
Exactly. I mean, you need to avoid what's called the autobiographical fallacy, which is where you people mistakenly believe that any work of creative art, you know, literature or music is necessarily a reflection of the life or opinions of the author. I mean, you know, artists and authors should be allowed to use their imagination and imagine improbable or even impossible things, and also depict accurately characters and behaviors of which they may strongly disapprove of or disagree with or, you know, really be repelled by. I mean,
When I directed Titus Andronicus, I wrote like a little prescript or something in the program where it was saying, yep, this is a story about revenge, but that doesn't mean that we are endorsing revenge here or something like that, like revenge and violence and, you know, all of that stuff. It's like, yes, we're showing you this stuff because, like, if you're going to fix something in the world, you have to be able to see it.
Right. Well, that is one of the reasons why the aesthetic, purely aesthetic view of art is ultimately incomplete. I mean, it's fine, you know, to want art to be beautiful, but if that's all it is, if it's just for getting a momentary sensation of, you know, of wow, you know, and then just move on, it's like, well, then what good is it? I think you're right. You need to allow art to be more expansive and more universally edifying than that.
Yeah.
Let's go ahead and wind this up. Let me just summarize that in England, the popular response to Dorian Gray was mostly disgust and outrage because people viewed it as apparently open advocacy of this lifestyle based solely upon gratification. They committed the autobiographical fallacy and thought that because Wilde wrote about all this, well, he is obviously endorsing all of this. Now, Americans, its reception in America was much more, I believe, correct in that they saw it as a cautionary tale. I mean, you could see it as an advocacy tale for the new hedonism, you know, or for a celebration of Victorian prudery and Puritanism giving away to these more libertine morals. Or this is what I think it is. I think it's a cautionary tale about the dangers of these things. You know, it's shining the light on evil accurately, even if somewhat, you know, obliquely. And, you know, Dorian Gray spent the second half of the book tormented by his awful deeds, and he came to a horrible end with his depravity and corruption on full display. So I think that Oscar Wilde was, he was by no means a black and white person. I mean, you know, one of the commentaries I read said that, you know, at the time he wrote this book, there was a lot of stuff in flux in his life and in his mind. And right up until, he was such a conflicted person because he converted to the Catholic faith on his deathbed. And he wrote some amazing stuff from prison where he just was reflecting on what had happened to him and everything. And and there's, you know, people go back and forth about, you know, the authenticity of a deathbed conversion after, you know, whatever kind of life you've lived. But, you know,
it's not for us to say, honestly.
No, exactly. It's not for us to say. It's for us to say, evaluate what's before our eyes, what was left behind. And then, you know, I mean, commend our souls and commend other people's souls to the mercy of God, basically. Right.
We can do our best. It's kind of like what the book is saying is that you can see what's going on the outside, but that doesn't necessarily reflect what's going on like in somebody's soul.
So if you've never read Dorian Gray, The Picture of Dorian Gray, I really recommend it. It's really great. It's a really great book. I do recommend an annotated version of it though, so you can sort of follow along and read and get really deep context to some of the things that he mentions. So we hope you have enjoyed this discussion, and we hope you all enjoyed the book. And we are delighted to be back with continuing season two of Splanknicks, and we will see you next time. Take care, everybody.
I don't know why I'm waving. It's a podcast.